Hi, I'm Steve Haddy, Chair of the Federation of Pioneer Specialists. Joining me today on the podcast is Anthony Oliadi, Head of Hillingdon Building Control. We'll be talking about design, building control procedures, and the Construction Youth Trust. Also, Ebenezer Adam Mosem, owner of Consultant Geofirma, and we'll be discussing his career journey and a new mentoring scheme for the industry. First, here's a message from our sponsor.
Casa Grande UK has been one of the leading suppliers of piling and drilling equipment to the UK and Irish foundation markets for over 30 years. We are the exclusive dealer for the UK and Ireland for a number of globally renowned manufacturers of this type of equipment, including Casa Grande, Hutti, Eurodrill, HD Engineering, PTC and STA. We can supply and service a huge range of equipment, including large diameter rotary and CFA piling rigs, small diameter drilling and mini piling rigs, diaphragm walling equipment, rotary and percussive heads, as well as vibro piling and grouting equipment. Please contact us by email at info@casagrandeuk.com or by phone 01296 651 043. That's 01296 651 043.
Welcome to the fourth edition of the Federation of Pioneer Specialists podcast. I'm joined today, first guest is Anthony Oliadi from Hillingdon Building Control, head of Hillingdon Building Control. He's also a fellow of the Royal Institution of Chartered Surveyors, president of the LABC, which is the Local Authority Building Control Group, and a past president of the LDSA. Anthony, have I missed anything out there?
Absolutely, you've not missed anything out there. That's everything. Good morning. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning. Thank you so much for joining me. Obviously, your experience is primarily building control, but
yes,
you're not a stranger to piling. In fact, you were one of the authors, or certainly introduced the LDSA paper on board piles a few years ago. Do you want to tell us about how that document came about and your involvement in that?
Yes. So when I was the president of the LDSA, the year that I was president, it was actually the LDSA was celebrating their 30th anniversary. And as part of that 30th anniversary that we for the year, it was to relook at the LDSA piling guide, because it's a document that's been produced in the past. And it had been produced a number of years ago, and we decided to revisit the guide and launch it on the actual 30th anniversary. We had assistance from I can't remember the company. I'm really sorry, but it's within the guide.
Arabs were quite prominent.
That's it. Apologies. I should have known that. but Arabs, they provided so much help with the guide and up looking at the guide and checking all the factors and everything like that, along with colleagues in the City of London Building Control, because they deal with a lot of piling projects there. So for me, it was really, really a proud moment for me, because we launched it at the 30th anniversary President's Lunch with Arabs there and stuff like that. And I think you can download it for free.
I did so this morning, actually, to check out your comments. And I think the LDSA have always been quite prominent in terms of directing advice around pile design. As I can see from the document, it's and the sort of the 30-year edition was to coincide with the Eurocode coming in, because that was the first time the Eurocode's really been referenced within an LDSA pile paper. But what I felt was really interesting in that document was it was talking a lot about the ground investigation and the quality of that, and using the quality and both the quantity to inform choices around the soil strength profile. Was there much conjecture around that approach, you know, the levels of discussions that were held at all?
There was a number of quite a lot, actually, because I recall several emails going back and forth between Arabs and colleagues in the City of London and myself looking at that particular issue. Now, I don't directly deal with piling in that sort of instance, or deep piles and things like that. So I was leaning very heavily on my colleagues in the city and Arabs in dealing with those scenarios and coming to a satisfactory conclusions. It was heated. It was very heated discussions we were having.
It did lead to quite a lot of discussion on the FPS technical committee about the merits of the paper. But I think there's some really useful stuff in there, and in terms of advancing the conversation about the use of SI data and the importance of having quality SI data in pole design. There was actually a couple of representatives from the Federation of Partner Specialists on the review board as well. There was Mark Pennington, who's at Balfour Beatty Ground Engineering, and also Stuart Norman from Kelpray. So it was great to have some input from the piling industry on there as well.
Yeah.
So I think our members would be really interested to know the sort of processes that a building control officer or building control company would go through when evaluating piles.
I'm sure your members would be aware of the different. You obviously have the private sector building control, you have the public sector building control, and I'm here on this podcast representing public sector, local authority building control. So in terms of how we generally deal with piling, a lot of the times, and I can only really talk from my experience, and in fact, I had a piling job that I went to look at yesterday, actually. But generally, by the time most local authorities, not all, most local authorities have an in-house structural engineer who would look at the pile design, look at the load factors and all that sort of stuff in the office. That information sometimes gets provided before the scheme starts. Most of the times when we go to site, by the time we get to site, a lot of the times of lately, the piles are already completed. And generally, the information that we would request post the piles being completed is copies of the pile logs and things like that. And we will check that against what's been provided, or maybe pass it on to our structural engineer. And then we would go and inspect the ground beams or whatever and coming upwards. So generally, it's done in my experience, we get there. But I do remember back in years ago, I used to go to see piling jobs before they were concrete, and we used to get a plumb bowl or tape measure and take it right down to the bottom, and test it, and get a tape measure, throw it, or get something go right just to test to see the depth of it. And I remember doing that, but that doesn't really happen nowadays. But
I've even heard some stories of people getting lowered down a pile that, I mean, hopefully this is a long, long time ago, but when people had to go down to the base of the pile to visually inspect how the pile was formed, so you're getting a good end bearing capacity.
Yes.
So there'd be a little cage attached to a crane.
Absolutely.
I mean, no idea how much this person was paid, but whatever it was, it wasn't enough. And they got lowered down to the bottom, had a torch, and make sure it was okay. Absolutely nuts. hopefully that's not happening anywhere
Those working practices are generally, it's a thing of the past with all the health and safety issues that has advanced on from there. But nowadays, generally, you might come along and see a few piles in action. But in my experience, most of the times it's pretty much nigh on completed, depending on the number of piles that are going in and the size of the scheme.
And of course, we've got instrumentation as well. So you don't physically need to see the bore all the time to understand the construction process. Certainly with the CFA piles, you can get a really good representation of how much concrete's gone in, whether it's gone in quickly enough. And I think in some ways, looking at that sort of information is probably more powerful than looking at for instance, something like an integrity test. You can probably gain more quality information from that process. You mentioned earlier about public sector versus private sector. Now, I think there was a time that all building control, correct me if I'm wrong here, Anthony, all building control was done by the local authority. And then you have people like the NHBC.
Correct.
And Premier Guarantee came along.
Yes.
I'm not sure when that change was and in what situations developers have got options. Can you just explain?
Well, I've been in building control for the purpose of the listeners to this podcast. I've been in building control about 23, 24 years. And I remember in my early days as a young trainee, majority of the work came through to local authority building control. The only one, NHBC were only dealing, they were the only private sector building control body out there. And they were just dealing in new housing. And then things changed. Please don't quote me if I'm wrong. I think it changed in around about the 80s or 90s. I can't remember the year where, and the introduction of private sector, more private sector building control companies came into it. It was all insurance led. And more companies came in into the market to service local authority, building control, which has led to today. You have an option. Developers have the option for building control to either go with local authority building control on their project or go with a private company. As a result of Grenfell, the whole system is now being looked at, and there could be changes how that's operated going forward. But it's the choice at the moment as to which building control provider you want to use is down to the developer, owner, builder, whatever you want to call it, whether they wish to use local authority, whether they wish to use a private approval.
Okay. So just pick up on a couple of those points then. So let's say it's a public sector project. Could a public sector project still have a private sector building control? Okay, it's
unfortunately, I have to say yes on that.
So let's say it's a schools project.
Yes,
The school could have a private sector building control authority. And I suppose as long as they're adhering to certain sets of regulations, there's no problem with that. Yeah. Okay, and you mentioned Grenfell, obviously a terrible disaster there. So how do you see that affecting the building control sector then?
Yes, and there's so much. I mean, regrettably, we're in the COVID-19 era, regrettably, but there's been so much going on from the fallout of Grenfell and the publication of the Dame Judith Hackett review. And we've also got the inquiry, which has now started up again. So there's. I also sit on. I'm a board of a board director for LABC. So I sit in on the board directors' meetings and hear a lot of what's going on in terms of post Grenfell. And there is a lot happening. I could take the whole podcast time up with what's happening.
Give us a few bullet points. I mean, for instance, is it likely that there will be certain buildings, as we know, Grenfell was quite a large high rise building. Is it likely that we're going to see buildings over a certain amount of stories move into that sort of public sector?
Correct. There's going to be they call them in-scope buildings. And these buildings are predominantly over 18 metres. And I think there's another key factor to it as well. So we're concentrating at the moment, or they're concentrating at the moment at what is called in-scope buildings, which are generally your high-rise residential buildings and dealing with the review is targeting how we're going to effectively police, if I can say it in that word, those sorts of buildings, in-scope buildings. And then later on, the scope is then to open out wider to deal with schools, hospitals, and so on and so forth as things start to develop. But at the moment, it's just looking at in-scope buildings over 18 metres, which is your bet, and the high-rise residential buildings. So there's so much going on in the background that only those in the industry are really involved in it. But things will be coming out in the media very, very soon on that. I can't tell you when, but soon, yeah.
And in terms of the local authority building controls, is there scope? I mean, they're not, presumably, not-for-profit organisations, but is their scope is, so with Hillingdon, can you only approve a building being constructed in Hillingdon? Or if somebody from Croydon comes to you and says, I've got this building, can you Can you approve it? Is there anything to stop you doing that?
There's things in place where you need to be have a certain level of qualification in local authority building. It's called levels. You have to be a level 6 fire safety specialist, and once you achieve that, and we have to each surveyor or level 6 surveyor has to go through a rigorous testing exam process. So once I'm a level 6 fire safety surveyor, I've gone and taken the test and passed and proved my competency, and that's the key word going forward is competency. And I've taken that test. So I, for example, if Croydon, as you've picked up, for needed help on a in-scope building, they could draw me in to come in and help them. Likewise, if we don't have any in-scope buildings in Hillingdon, but if we did have an in-scope building in Hillingdon and I needed more expertise somewhere else, I can draw that in from another local authority, providing that they are a level 6 fire safety specialist surveyor. They've got that qualification.
That's good. Obviously, the key is to make sure that all the structures that we've got out there are safe, and we avoid disasters in the future. Let's turn to your presidency of the LABC. Do you want to tell us a little bit more about that organisation and how you came to assume the role?
Absolutely. Yeah. So I'd like to think most of your or all the listeners are aware of LABC, Local Authority Building Control, and what we are the LABC is the governing body that basically oversees all the local authority building control teams in England and in Wales. It's England and Wales, and I sit as the president for this year. And as part of my part of each president's year, you support a charity. My charity this year that I'm supporting is Construction Youth Trust. That's a youth charity that deals with kids from different backgrounds and trying to help them get into the built environment sector. And I understand that there's some work going on between yourselves and Construction Youth, or there's discussions happening at the moment between yourselves and Construction Youth Trust. So fantastic charity to support.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit more about that. So Eb's our next guest, and I had a really fun chat with Charlotte and Tom from Construction Youth Trust last week. And we've invited them in to meet the managing directors of all of the companies in the Federation of Piling Specialists, and want to explore a bit more about how we can work together. So obviously, they work with young people. They've got a few different courses running already. Are you able to tell us a little bit more about those courses and how they work with young people?
If I can talk about, excellent. If I can just mention a couple of things that I've done with them pre-lockdown. I mean, everything they're doing now, I understand it well, which is quite obvious, is all online-based. But before the lockdown occurred, they had a course called Budding Builders, where they had these young kids that were, I think the word is neat, and not
in employment, education, training. I think that's right.
So they had these kids that they brought in for a week's course, Budding Builders, which I got involved in. I went along. It was as part of this, the week's course was a Employer's Day, and I went along, and along with some other colleagues from different parts of the construction industry, had a chat with these kids. And also they had a workshop in the afternoon where they were doing some carpentry work and things like that. So I got involved in that, sort of shadowing, seeing what they do, and talking to them while they were in the workshop. So that's one of the courses that Construction Youth does amongst many. They go into schools, they go into colleges, and all about the built environment sector.
Yeah, I just got a taste of it from our conversation with them. But I know that, as you say, they go into schools, they work with these people that aren't in education or training, and they provide mentoring. Now, I want to speak a little bit more about mentoring later on with Ebenezer, and I'll bring you back into the conversation at that point, Anthony, as well. But I know that they were also keen to facilitate apprentices for our businesses. So yeah. I'd be really interested to see how that develops, particularly given the government's recent commitment to support employers more with financially with the appointment of apprentices. Let's also look at some of your other objectives. I mean, a year obviously is not a long time to develop things within the LABC, but I see that you've also identified work on the environment. Now, the construction industry and building contributes almost 40% of world carbon emissions. What role has the LABC got to play in improving that?
There's huge. Any sort of consultations that come out from the government with regards to changes to approved document L, and there's been a number of consultations that have come out on that specific subject. LABC are always there to, or literally one of the first to comment on government consultations with regards to that. And that's where we play a key role. As an organisation, because we speak as one voice for all public sector building control bodies in responding to government comments and government legislation where required. And that's the powerful voice that LABC has, you know, the one voice for all the building control bodies.
Sure. I think legislation, building control, it's got a huge role to play in improving our performance in terms of the environment. At the moment, the Federation of Pioneer Specialists, for our listeners' benefit, also extremely active in working to improve our association with the environment. We're just starting a series of webinars on sustainability. And the idea is that we're inform people more about the techniques to facilitate lower carbon solutions for our customers. The first workshop is on the use of the carbon calculator, and we'll also provide an overview on piling and its effect on the environment. You can also read a blog that I'm releasing today about moving ground engineering towards a greener future. Anthony, thank you so much. I just want to pick up on one of the points that we talked about there, which is mentoring, and introduce our next guest, Ebenezer Adam Mosem. Ebs, we're working on the mentor scheme together, but before we go into that, could you give us some background on your career?
No, just a bit about me. My background is I started out as a civil engineer at the beginning. Well, I graduated in civil engineering, after which I decided I wanted to go into geotechnical engineering, which is where I started my career at, working for a company called the Royal Haskoning. And that's kind of where I cut my, started out working as a geotechnical engineer, learning my stuff, which was a very interesting and I'd say quite exciting period because, you know, I was working within a very small team. I had very good access to my boss, which was, again, very good because we talk about role models and people that kind of instill within you that thing. I was lucky enough to have a good boss line manager who had spent a lot of time with me, and that was because we were in a small team. So I was lucky enough to, I had a training agreement, which meant that I was able to get that done fairly quickly, and because obviously my next aim was to get chartered. I left there. I went to work for a company called ACOM, Haber-Mortel, but called ACOM now, where I was, I did a bit more geotechnics relating to structures. And that's kind of where I was probably firstly introduced into piling, which is one of the things that I kind of spend a lot of my time doing. And, you know, my business kind of spends, we do a lot of piling work, pile design and such. After working for ACOM for a bit of time, I then went to work for a company called Skanska, I think everybody knows. I spent quite a few fun years there. First of all, working for a company called Skanska Technology. They are the consultancy part of the Skanska Group. And I was based there as a geotechnical engineer within that team. There were two of us at the time. And again, it was kind of dealing more with construction projects, whereas before we were dealing with probably more downstream, the design before it got to the contractor. Whilst working within Skanska, we were working on generally on live projects where things had to be solved there and then. So that kind of pushed me closer towards the contractors and appreciating the budgets and constraints behind getting projects off the ground. It's not just about, because as a consultant, you tend to do a lot of write reports, but it's about getting projects built. And that's what I got to appreciate whilst working for Skanska Technology. And then I went to go off a company called Skanska Cementation, who put the piles in the ground. And those, I was there for 3 years. And in those 3 years, I got involved in some really good and meaty projects. I got to understand the piling industry, you know, the economics behind it, you know, how piles are designed, the nitty-gritty behind that. And so those 3 years I spent working with some very experienced and knowledgeable people kind of set me on my way before I decided to go on my own path, as one would say. So I initially freelanced for a while before setting up Geofirma. And we've been going for 3-4 years. We do and manage geotechnics, ground investigations, slope stability, sawnails, piling, gravel assessments, basement impact assessments. So we do the whole geotechnical shebang, although a lot of what we do is piling, which is why we are associate members of the FPS, and obviously how I got more involved with Steve, I'd say.
Yeah, and what have you found to be the benefits of being an associate member of the Federation of Partner Specialists?
I think that the main benefit is actually getting down to sit down with others, because I'm a member of the technical committee, and we have quarterly meetings where we actually look at problems that face the industry from a design point of view. So you previously talked about the LDSA. One of the meetings we had was actually discussing our response to the LDSA report and how, as a body, we were going to our concerns about what was stated within the document. So that's where bodies such as the FPS can kind of make things happen. We've also been involved with the Eurocode, which is obviously in its where there's going to be another phase. I wouldn't say draft, but the Eurocodes are being re-implemented again. I think they're going to be issued, I think, next year. So we've also had a way of representing our views on those documents. And also, it's also good to, because a lot of my clients are members of the FPS, so it's nice to meet them and, you know, have a bit of dialogue with them and discuss how the industry's going and projects and all that. So there are benefits in being associate members. We have found it very useful in terms of what we do.
One of the key points there is ensuring that there are role models. People may not realise that perhaps you're a black man. You faced a lot of challenges joining the industry and progressing in the industry. And I'd like for you to share some of those stories and the prejudice that you faced.
Okay, one of the first experiences I had was when I finished at university. I went to Imperial College, where I did a degree in civil engineering. I graduated about 25 years ago. Things have changed since then. But I remember my very first interview, which was on the Milk Round. For those of you who remember what the Milk Round is, I don't know whether they still exist, but that was when companies, usually the large ones, would come to universities. They generally tended to come to Imperial because it had kind of a good reputation. And they would interview potential undergraduates with a view of potentially offering them jobs when they graduated at the end of the year. I'm not going to mention any names or any companies, but my first interview was with a contractor who came to the university and was the director of that contracting company. And interview went well. We had a chat, and then at the end he said to me, well, Ebenezer, we've had a nice interview, but why should I offer you a job when what you're going to do is you'll take the job and then return back to your country after a few years? I said, well, why would I? I'm British. I was born here. Why would I want to go back to my country afterwards? Well, that's kind of how the interview ended. In those days, it wasn't the done thing to call things out and you know, go to the university body and make a complaint. So that kind of stayed with me. And I mean, I didn't get the job. I didn't think I would. But that's kind of the kind of discrimination that my career started out on. It was funny because whilst I was at university, I experienced very little, I'll say, discrimination. Imperial was a very mixed setting, lots of overseas students. It was fun, it was great, I enjoyed myself there. But towards the end, when I had to start thinking, oh, I was going out to the real world, it kind of dawned on me that a lot of my friends who were getting job offers, I mean, I did get 2-1, so I wouldn't say I would have had a problem in performing in that role. To be honest, that wasn't necessarily the problem. But it appeared that I wasn't getting any replies to my, I'd say, applications. I applied to near on 100 companies, and very few actually replied, and very few actually interviewed me. I can count them on one hand, the companies that actually agreed to meet up with me and have a chat. And I remember I was having a discussion with one of my lecturers at Imperial College, was sat in the soil mechanics lab, which was a nice place where a lot of the researchers, I happened to, because during one of the summer stints, I had actually worked on one of the research projects with a piling PhD at the time. And so I got to know a lot of the researchers, a lot of the lecturers. So this lecturer, who's still around, he's still connected with Imperial, said, Ebenezer, have you got a job? I said, well, no, I haven't yet. And this was in the third year, probably I'd say May, June, when everybody who was going to get jobs had been offered jobs, and most people had. He said, Ebs, I can't understand, Ebs. You're a good student. You're very engaging. You are the year rep for the department. But I don't quite understand why you don't have a job. I said, well, I don't know. I can't quite put my finger on it, but I'm going to continue looking. And that was probably when it first struck me that I might have a problem, if you see what I mean. I'd never really, you go through your degree, you think if you perform well, you work hard, that, and especially if you go to a reasonable university, that you will get a job. And, you know, that wasn't what happened. It was a bit more complicated than that.
Yeah, it's not always overt prejudice or racism, let's call it what it is. Sometimes there's a unconscious bias there. And clearly we need to educate ourselves as in the construction community about that. I think the Black Lives Matter movement has been really important in doing that. Anthony, have you faced much prejudice yourself in your experience of working in the construction industry and as in building control?
I suppose the answer to that question is yes, some directly, some indirectly, but it's never really fazed me, and I've just kept ploughing through through those challenging times to effectively get to where I am today. It's not been an easy journey, and that's why something like working with Construction Youth Trust has been an important factor to me, to be a role model to the youth, the younger generation out there, to say that, because in this industry, if they can see someone that looks like them, to help to say, well, if he can get there, so can I. So yes, it's happened, but you know, I've just through that, I've just continued going and armed myself.
Yeah, the importance of role models is key. Ebs, you shared an experience of going into one of the FPS committees recently, and I think you were the only.
Yeah, so I was the only black person there, and the only person who wasn't male was taking the minutes. So it was myself, a black man, and a lady who, and that was out taking the minutes, and that was probably, I was about probably 40 people there. You wouldn't really accept that, I would say, in other industries. It would be very, very noticeable. But unfortunately, in construction, it's not often called out, and people don't. And it was actually quite interesting. After that particular meeting, that's one of the things that started me thinking about or coming to you and this putting up this mentorship scheme that we're talking about. I spoke with a couple of people after, a couple of guys after the meeting, and they said, "Well," and we turned to the subject of diversity, and I said, "Well, look, I'm the only black person here," and this lady looked and said, "Well, actually, it's very true, and we do actually need to do something about this." And they were very sympathetic to what I'd actually just said. So I think a lot of people nowadays are noticing the lack of black and Asian and other minorities within these kind of settings, and also noticing the kind of the gender imbalance that we have within the consortium, and are trying to do something about it, which I would say maybe a few years ago, it wasn't the in thing. So it's great to see that there are people that are willing to make these changes. It's just now about making those changes and getting things started. So people like Anthony, who are positive, being positive role models and putting themselves behind, such movements as i.e. Construction Youth Trust, and also us looking at our mentoring scheme that we're thinking of launching, which I'm presumably going to talk about a bit later about Steve. Yeah. Those initiatives, I think, are needed. And I also think there's an important thing that Anthony mentioned earlier. I think some people, when they experience discrimination or prejudice or any view of kind and any negativity, they turn around and say, "This isn't for me."
Yes. Yeah.
Some people will stay in there and fight it out. I've stayed in there and fought it out. Anthony has. And it was worth it. I'm happy with what I do. I run my own business. And I can also help others who feel the same way. And I think that's kind of what we're trying to look at. I think because people don't necessarily feel that welcomed in within the industry sometimes, that might be a reason why we do have such low numbers, unfortunately.
Yeah, we've spoken before about support networks and potentially within the piloting industry. We won't mention any names, but Ebs and I were having a conversation yesterday about somebody that was struggling with racism within their job role. Where can black and Asian and minority ethnic people go to get support currently within the construction industry? Is there people that are out there as a group that are going to be sympathetic? How do we direct and support those currently?
That's a difficult one. There are some groups that, such as the AFBE, which I'm involved in, which is a group for BME engineers of all disciplines. But again, it's what can be done about it. Unfortunately, these groups don't have the power to do much, because as we probably appreciate, most senior level persons are probably not black or Asian, or they are. So that's not where the power is. So we can complain, but it doesn't necessarily mean anything's going to happen. And I think that is the problem.
I know of a group, Diversity Surveyors, who also are making inroads within the Royal Institution of Chartered Surveyors, and that's another group that is out there. So they're there. It's a long road. It's a long road.
There almost needs to be a critical mass of people before the networks can properly be set up. So obviously the mentoring scheme that we're talking about is designed to try and help facilitate that. At the moment, we've concentrated our efforts on university students, and that's going to be the focus in trying to improve that transition from student to industrial placement. So we've had a huge amount of support. So put this idea out there probably 2 months ago, rightly or wrongly, decided to say, well, we're going to start by seeing who would like to be a mentor for this scheme. And we had an incredible response with people wanting to be mentors. We then realised that actually we're going to need a bit of help with this, some proper professional help. So we've just engaged with a group called Steer Mentors, who have got experience of delivering mentor schemes and training for the mentors. And it's going to be a professional setup. We've got buy-in now across the geotechnical community. So I sit on a group called the Ground Forum, which is an umbrella body for a number of different geotechnical related trade bodies. Mm-hmm. And Ebs and I provided a presentation to them last week, and it was an incredibly positive response. So the objective is in year one to have 40 mentees, and we'll help them with their career development. Also looking at internships and work placement opportunities. And so the administrators of the scheme will be reaching out to universities, to employers, and trying to make sure that those opportunities are available going forward. Mm-hmm. And so further down the line, hopefully we can start to build more of a network for people from underrepresented backgrounds.
Excellent. That's brilliant.
When it comes to encouraging people into the industry, it's not just about having people to look up to. It's also about aspirational projects. We all know that there are some really exciting opportunities when you get into the construction industry. But what would you say is your most memorable project that you've worked on?
One of the most striking piling projects that I will never forget throughout my career is, I'm a huge, and I'll say it on the podcast, I'm a huge Arsenal supporter. Boo. And I was involved because I previously worked for London Borough of Islington Building Control, and at the time the Emirates Stadium was being built. So as you can imagine, as a Arsenal supporter, and also having to see the construction of the stadium for the football club you support, was a fantastic experience. And I'd go down there and have a look at the piles as they were going down and things like that. So as you can imagine, for a stadium, it's for me, that's a once in a lifetime project. I've probably never seen another stadium built in my career.
Absolutely. I'll let you know that was a project that I was involved in. It was about, was it 2005, 2006? That's about 14, 15 years.
You were involved in the Emirates as well, were you?
Yeah, that's a project I was involved were in.
Were you?
Emirates.
That's a coincidence.
Yes, I was.
What a coincidence. I did the building control function on the stadium.
I won't mention any companies, but yeah, it was a job that I was involved in. Even if it was, I remember being involved in the tender stage for it and attending a few meetings and stuff. But yeah, it was one of the larger projects that I'd been involved with. And yeah. I'm not an Arsenal supporter, but it's a nice thing. My brother is.
I think the Spurs one might have trumped it, and I've got no allegiance to Spurs, I'm afraid. But I think what it does demonstrate is that iconic buildings, sports stadiums, they're the sort of things that really engage with young people and can inspire people to come into the industry. And it's exciting projects to be proud of, and to be proud of being a civil engineer. So I can absolutely understand why you love being part of that, and I'm a big football fan as well.
Well, I guess part of it is a lot of us as engineers are not great at showing that passion kind of, you know, so that's why people aren't inspired. And I think if, you know, if we kind of said what we did and, you know, related to football context, which most a lot of people are interested in, we would get people, oh, that's wonderful.
All sort of fantastic.
Even looking at I'm not a Tottenham's fan, but I mean, looking at their stadium, you know, it is something, you know, it was a great project and it looks marvelous, you know, it looks wonderful. Yeah. And I think that's how we can inspire. Absolutely. People coming into the industry.
Yeah. And I also, sorry, Steve, apologies. Sure. I also find that having these podcasts and these forums where we can discuss and they can hear our voices, some webinars, they can see individuals, is so important. It's so important. And they know that we're out there. You know, there are individuals like us involved in these projects, involved in the industry, and there for them to look up to.
Yeah, and there's all sorts of different ways of communicating with people. And certainly podcasts is a form of media that really is connecting with a lot of people. I've had fantastic feedback already, and the numbers on the podcast in terms of listeners have far exceeded any expectations that we had for the success of it. Part of it is getting the engagement with people after the podcast. So you kindly offered to connect with people, Anthony, after it. I know, Ebs, you'd be happy to take emails as well.
Yeah, definitely. Emails, absolutely, anything. Yes. Yeah.
I mean, they can look me up on LinkedIn, Anthony Oliedi, Oloyede. That's Anthony Oliedi, Oloyede. If you look, the best you can connect with me on LinkedIn, send me an email through there and I'll get in touch.
And likewise, you can find me on LinkedIn, where I am fairly active. Ebenezer Aidan Mosen. So send me an email. You can also come through our website, Geofirma. So you can contact me. You've got any questions about how I've kind of got to do what I'm doing, and just want any tips or any advice, just send me a line. I'm quite friendly and, you know, I will reply.
Right. Well, brilliant, guys. Thank you so much for today.
Thank you.
Learned a lot. Really enjoyed the conversation as well. So look forward to speaking to you both more about the mentoring scheme and the construction you trust in the months and the years ahead.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you.
I hope that you enjoyed this edition of the FPS podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to share with your contacts. If you have any suggestions for topics or guests, then do send them across to me. You can find me on LinkedIn. Thanks for listening.